Blake Murphy,
Justin Cuthbert, J.D. Bunkus, whose life has changed dramatically since we realized I have the power to mute him in the Zoom that runs parallel to this. I don't have the power to mute his actual mic, unfortunately. Yeah.
Someday.
Our tech, Vic's in my ear. I do. So he can do it. So this is why we respect Vic. The beats, and he has the power to silence us. Maybe the power to explain to us why everyone has suddenly decided that Timothy Liljegren needs to be the poster boy for a 2008 baseball-like debate in hockey. Our pal Ian Tulloch, hockey analyst at the Hockey News, at Ian Graff on Twitter. Ian, what's up, man? How are you?
Not too bad. I know JD is not a huge Liljegren fan, so yeah, let's get into this.
I think it's more that JD's a fan of using stats within reason to complement what you're seeing on the ice. Am I phrasing that better, JD, than you don't like Liljegren?
Yeah, I think that's probably the way to... Here's what I think about Liljegren, is that if a stat tells you that he's one of the best defensemen in hockey, then the stat is probably pretty flawed, or more flawed than some people are willing to admit. Let's put it that way.
So, and I think that's definitely fair. I think when we're looking at something like expected goals, context is something that matters. And I know what you're referencing, the fact that Liljegren's top five in the NHL, he might be ranked first right now in expected goals at 5-on-5. I think the sheltered usage definitely factors in there. I know someone like myself was a huge fan of Travis Dermott many moons ago because he put up excellent 5-on-5 expected goals numbers against sheltered competition, but he hasn't been able to do it in top four usage. So I think that's definitely a key factor here when we're evaluating these players. Liljegren's been winning his minutes when he plays on a third pair, but I know JD doesn't trust him when he moves up into a second pair or top pair situation. And I think I'd agree with that. I think realistically you prefer him on a bottom pair right now, but I think it's also fair to say he's winning the minutes that he's in on the third pair, but you have to take it with a grain of salt when you're comparing him to guys like Grizzlick and McAvoy who are doing it on a first pair.
Well, we need to talk about five-man units, too, as well. Like, I think that's something that's missing when we're contextualizing things, is that for a lot of the season, Sheldon Keefe was endeavoring to get Rasmus Sandin and Timothy Liljegren out there with Austin Matthews. And if Austin Matthews is doing Austin Matthews things in the offensive zone, certainly those expected goal numbers are going to increase for a sheltered minutes defenseman like Timothy Liljegren.
Absolutely. And I think whenever we're talking about evaluating players in hockey and we're talking about defensemen who are facing tough matchups, we spend so much time talking about the quality of competition. We don't spend much time talking about the quality of your teammates when all the research shows that actually has a much bigger impact on your results. So I think whenever we're making these assessments on players, you really got to pay attention to who the player is playing with, because if you're playing all of your minutes with an excellent player or most of your minutes with an excellent player, that's actually going to impact things way more than the competition that you're facing. So I know it's something that stats nerds love to talk about, but I'd love to see it make its way into the mainstream conversation a bit more often, because realistically, that's where more of the impact is coming from. It's who you play with, not necessarily who you play against.
I'm glad you said that, Ian, because if we get time to talk trade targets, I want to pick at that a little bit, because it's, you know, this conversation came up on the show a couple times this week around Josh Manson and how do you translate how he plays with a Cam Fowler to how he might fit with a Morgan Rielly. And, you know, those interactions between pieces are a little bit of a black box right now. So for anyone who's unaware, among defensemen with at least 250 minutes played this year, Timothy Liljegren ranks first in expected goals percentage at 5-on-5. Rasmus Sandin is fourth. Travis Dermott is 15th. I don't think that would back up the eye test of a lot of people who watch the Leafs. And I think that anytime you have an extreme stat like that, it's worth taking a closer look at it. And in Liljegren's case, he's played very sheltered minutes in terms of how often he starts in the offensive zone versus the defensive zone. Sandin's a little bit more neutral, as is Dermott. So I guess, Ian, when we're trying to figure things out, like, hey, just how badly do you need an upgrade? Or, hey, does Liljegren or Sandin have upward mobility across your pairs? What do we do with this? Because obviously you can watch, but you have to trial and error some of these pairs, as the Leafs have been doing lately. And we already run into an issue of a hockey season is kind of a small sample for on-ice impact kind of stuff. And then we have to chop it into smaller and smaller samples because we want to see it at 5-on-5. We want to control for defense partner. We want to control for deployment. Where are we at, like, as a hockey analysis community when you see three Leafs defensemen in the top 15 in a stat, it doesn't quite line up with how things look and how things feel, but this is the data available to us.
Yeah, and anytime you're using stats to try to make an assessment, context is key. And I think that's such a big factor here, is that those three defensemen you named are all playing third pair usage. And it's way easier to put up strong numbers on a third pair who's going up against third and fourth lines than it is to do it on a first pair who's going up against the Connor McDavid and Austin Matthews of the world on a nightly basis. So that's definitely a key factor there. When it comes to trying to figure out which players can make the jump and which players can't, I'd love to tell you I have a perfect answer. I'd be making a lot more money if I could accurately make that assessment. But there are lots of examples of defensemen who try to make that jump and they can't do it. The Travis Dermotts of the world, the Marc-Andre Bergerons of the world. There are a laundry list of them who can't make the jump. But then there's also guys like Nate Schmidt and Braden McNabb and Shea Theodore and other players who have dominated third-pairing usage, been moved up into the lineup, and the things that they do well in the third pair, moving the puck up.
We may have lost Ian there for a second. So while we try to reconnect with Ian, JD, I know you have something on this.
Well, so there's a couple things. I don't mean to have Ian just kind of come on and this ends up being like, you know, bully ball where the three of us all go and say like, hey, this is what it's like. But this is the thing. So that stat goes out there and people obviously tag me in it because this is some, I've been on a pretty strong position that I do not believe Liljegren is a top four guy. In fact, I believe almost as strongly as anything that the one thing that you cannot have is a Morgan Rielly Timothy Liljegren pairing. So I get tagged in all these things and people keep bringing up this stuff about how I'm too hard on the player or whatever and blah 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 blah. But I actually think that this is like, one, this should be a fun hockey conversation, and it's unfortunately devolved into something that's like, it's eye test versus this. It's like, no. I think only a bozo in 2022 is using only one thing at their disposal. What I think I guess I get frustrated with at times is that oftentimes the people who provide these statistics, they put it out there and then they'll be like, oh, but this isn't exactly how I feel about it. I'm just kind of putting the stat out there. And you go, yeah, but you're putting a stat out there like this and it's drawing in a ton of people who go, see, this guy is incredible. See, this guy is this. And the problem is to me is that what I think is the coolest part about the Liljegren discussion is not whether or not he's an NHL player, because I think at this point it's pretty well established that he is. The debate that he isn't an NHL player anymore is gone. He can clearly play. There are things Timothy Liljegren can do that are of real value to the NHL. Sheltered minutes are tough to evaluate, and they're not exactly a great gospel, but there's this whole thing of, you know, you look at these numbers and you go, well, I think that these are sheltered, and people scream from the rooftop, they go, it's because you don't understand the statistics, they account for these things, they account for, no, they don't. They don't account for them perfectly. Just because you can account for something doesn't mean you can encompass something, and when I look at numbers like this, I get infuriated by that pushback from people. It's dogmatic. I hate dogma when it comes to anything, especially sports stats, and especially ones that are in hockey. And so that's why it was funny to me yesterday having Blake reach out to me privately and express his frustration with the Liljegren stat. You know why? You know who really understands analytics? Blake Murphy. Have you ever read a Blake Murphy piece before? You think that you on Twitter, random person, have the ability to break down how these formulas get together the way that Blake does? Like, are you out of your minds? Are you out of your minds? This is him. And so there are people that are kind of charlatans who purport themselves as these guys that really believe in these numbers. And they're good. Like, it's good to have these numbers. You know why they're good? Because they force people like me who have these beliefs that a third pairing is supposed to be a certain way. I go, I want a third pairing where there's a big defenseman that kills a play and who I can trust. And when I get these numbers and I see them properly contextualized and properly discussed, I think to myself, is that smart? Should the Leafs care about having that type of a defenseman? Is there actually a value in going out and getting somebody that's that stay-at-home type in a third pair like a Lyubushkin, who I love, right? I go, oh, I'm comfortable with Lyubushkin. He clears the front of the net. Or is it better to have a Liljegren? And the numbers would tell you that it's better to have a Liljegren-Sandin pairing. And that challenges conventional thinking. And I think that's smart. I think that's a good conversation for hockey fans to have. And for me, a dinosaur who doesn't believe in those things, it's impossible impossible when you're faced with this kind of data to ignore it completely. And it forces you to look at Liljegren a little bit differently. It forces you to be sharper in your analysis when you have this stuff. But when you make it dogma, when you make it, this is a certainty, and you don't understand it, and you're an idiot, and you need to be outside the conversation, you push people away. And that is what drives me nuts about all of this, is that if we can just get to having guests like Ian Tullock on, that's why I like having Ian on, is because he's good at explaining these things. He not only understands them, but he contextualizes them. And even if the two of us disagree fundamentally on something or push back with one another, we end up in this better place. So maybe it's just, again, a frustration with social media, but my God, it's just... Like, who are – this is what I've said before about the analytics community, and I mean their fans probably more than anyone, is when people challenge, there's never any, oh, okay. It's always met with this anger, right? I mentioned Coolbet Chris last week where he has that tweet, and some of the most prominent people in the analytics community are, like, name-calling. And it just makes no sense to me why, if these numbers are that solid, that you would feel the need to defend them in that way where it feels personal. And I just don't like that. I'm just not there right now. Anyways, Ian joins us back on the line. Ian, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hopefully my call doesn't drop this time. But
yeah,
I like what you're saying there. I like the rant. I like it overall because I think it does a good job trying to explain what some of the frustrations are when we log on to Twitter and we see a number that we don't necessarily agree with. And we're trying to find a way to understand, okay, wait, why does that number say what it says? I think whenever I'm going through my spreadsheets, whenever I'm going through my graphs, I'm trying to understand why things are happening on the ice and can I use any kind of information to try to contextualize what's happening. And with Timothy Liljegren, I think he's a perfect example of, like you said, he's not what most fans would think of when they think of a third-pairing defenseman, the kill the play in front of the net, cross-checking guys, defensively responsible PK. He's more of what I would call a modern third-pairing defense, where he's a puck mover. He's really good at going back on a loose puck, making the exit pass out of the D zone, getting you up the ice. A lot of his assists this year are on plays like that, where he makes a stretch pass up the ice, and he finds a way to get the play moving. So I think that's one of the hard parts here, is that when he's on the ice at 5-on-5 against sheltered minutes, he's winning those minutes. It's very clear. But what proves a guy is able to move up the lineup and play second pair minutes or first pair minutes. I think that's where coaches would argue that the ability to defend in your own zone, the ability to take away the front of the net, to take away passes through the middle of the net, I think that's where they would argue that we're not measuring those things properly. And I don't like appealing to authority. I don't like saying NHL coaches are always right. But I also don't like saying NHL coaches are always wrong. And the number that I'm citing here is definitely right. So I'd have to think there's a healthy medium somewhere. I'm curious what you guys look at when you're thinking of defensemen who have the ability to move up the lineup. What are you looking at on the ice in terms of your eye test? Because I know defensive zone play is what comes up when we're talking about Timothy Liljegren. I tend to value puck moving and the ability to get it out of your defensive zone so that you're not on defense, but the ability to actually defend against the cycle, that tends to matter in the playoffs. And I think that's what a lot of people would argue.
No, I'm with you, Ian. I mean, I think that's the one big test for defensemen that are moving up is how they defend the cycle, how they actually defend without the puck when the opposition is buzzing around and trying to make something happen. And I think that's the one thing that Liljegren is struggling mainly with right now is managing that step up with his first-pairing deployment.
Well, Justin, because just to look at right now, look at the way that the Leafs are getting scored against, right? Their goaltenders are struggling, but how are the pucks going in? So at first it was defending against the rush. And you know what? I would say Liljegren, one of his more impressive things has been this season, in season, in terms of getting better at. And again, I'm not a scout. I'm not a professional in terms of this regard. But I think that I've watched enough hockey where I can at least have a decent opinion on it, is that I think Liljegren has improved as a on-the-rush defensive player. I think that's somewhere where he has shown really legitimate growth, and I think that's a really important thing. But yeah, to me, if you look at where the Leafs are really having a tough time, it's clearing out that front of the net and it's killing plays in their own end. And when you get closer to the playoffs, that becomes a bigger issue because that's what's going to be it. Is how do you get your back broken? It's off of a tip that's in front of the net. It's off of a guy getting into those home run areas where you get those good opportunities to score. And I feel like it hurts your value as a team. I mean, this isn't exactly hot, ticky stuff. It's pretty obvious. But it hurts you as a team when you don't have balance throughout your roster on your blue line. And this is my contention with Liljegren overall and in general is, how do you value him versus how you value the rest of your roster right now? Because the Leafs don't exactly have a lot of those kind of players that can kill a cycle, that are good in front of their net. Morgan Rielly is not good at that. That's an area where he struggles. So what are you going to do? Are you going to play him with someone who also struggles with that? Well, that's how you end up with plays like you've been seeing with those two guys on the ice together. Are you going to pair that with Rasmus Sandin in the playoffs, a guy who also struggles with that? Like, it leaves you vulnerable in some places to get playoff-style goals scored against you. And that's what I think the challenge is. What is the cost-benefit analysis when the hockey changes? I think it was Shane O'Brien came on with us last year, and he had this really great point of, I feel bad for GMs because they have to create one team for a regular season and then another team for the playoffs. And that's sort of how I feel about the Leafs blue line right now, as I go, this is workable right now. This is obviously workable because we're seeing it have great success, and we are seeing these numbers bear out where they say, hey, Timothy Liljegren is really good. And you say, that's awesome. Good to know. But I don't feel that same confidence heading into the playoffs. And some of that is probably my traditionalist thinking, but part of that is based on, you know, what you do see with the puck going in the net against the Leafs right now. So yeah, Ian, when I look at stuff, I try to evaluate just, do you have balance on your blue line? Because if Liljegren is the guy where they needed a puck-moving defenseman who could skate, and that was the real thing that this roster was missing, then I'd be desperate for a guy like that. But to me, still right now, is they're missing that balance, and they've got actually one too many guys that is more closer to his mold of player.
And I really like the discussion when it comes to the differences between regular season hockey and playoff hockey. I don't think there's enough research about that in the public sphere right now. I think it's definitely a factor that coaches and GMs are considering when they're constructing their rosters and they're going into the trade deadline trying to address their weaknesses. I watch a lot of basketball just like you guys, and there's such a drastic difference from the regular season to the playoffs that it really molds roster construction. It really molds the way that we think about these players. In hockey, I know that that's where a lot of the old school takes will come from, and that you need a Ben Chiarot, you need a Roman Polak, and to some extent, I can understand the importance of physicality and winning those battles in front of the net. But again, I get really concerned with overvaluing those traits over puck moving ability, over, like you said, defending the rush, which is something Timothy Liljegren does well. So how do you find that balance? Like you said, how do you find a guy who can help your roster when it comes to defending the cycle, but not at the expense of being stuck in your own end all the time? I know Nikita Zaitsev, this has taken us back a few years, was someone that Babcock loved because he killed cycles. He trusted him in his own end. The problem is that he never advanced puck up the ice, and he was stuck in his own end 45% of the time. That's not something you want in the modern game. You want someone who can move it up the ice so that they're not defending that often. So I'm stuck here because I don't have a perfect answer for you. I really wish I did.
But no one does. That's the point. No one does, Ian. No one does. I don't have a perfect answer. You don't have a perfect answer. I think that the conclusion that we all keep coming to together is that, hey, what's hilarious about all this is that the only time that you figure out, like, hey, who here is kind of BS, it's the person who takes the most extreme position of, I know it, and my position is correct, and this opinion is real. That's where I look at you and go, oh, my God, this is insufferable. That's what gets you muted or blocked on the feed.
Well, how about this? How about instead of saying Timothy Liljegren's definitely this because of this, let's use the information to our best ability. Like, clearly there is a benefit to having Timothy Liljegren as an option. His best has come in that sheltered third pair where they can weaponize him a little bit. So in a perfect world, and it isn't a perfect world right now for the Maple Leafs because they are missing a top four defenseman and they have to bring Liljegren up in the lineup, would be to have options with that third pair. How about you weaponize it when you can with Liljegren and Sandin, and when you can't weaponize it, when you need to play a more defensively responsible brand, you have Labushkin and Sandin, and you just play it by ear like that. Like, Sheldon Keefe has options at his disposal depending on the matchup. But in order to have that perfect world, you need that other top four defenseman because Liljegren is being pulled out of that position. So, Ian, you know, we've got some, we've had your, you know, your take on who might be a trade target before, but this is something that changes over time and changes by needs and changes by situation. So if you're looking at, you know, maybe trade lists or just other teams, what would be the ideal acquisition in your mind to fix what is, you know, still a defense core that's performing to some degree, but by the eye test clearly has some imperfections?
So when I'm trying to look at who a team should sign or who a team should draft or who a team should trade for, I always come back to just a simple concept of best player available. Who is on the market right now among defensemen, let's say? Who's the best player overall? Not necessarily who's the best defensive defenseman, not who's the toughest, strongest defenseman, but 200-foot impact on the game of hockey, who is going to help you win? Based on all the defensemen I've seen, I still come back to Damon Severson. And I know that that upsets some people because he's not as physically strong in front of the net. I know a bunch of Leafs fans saw him fail to defend a 2-on-1 in one of the most embarrassing displays of hockey that I've ever seen. And I get it. I get that frustration. But over the last three seasons, when he's on the ice, he's moving play up the ice, and he's in the top, I want to say 80th, maybe 85th percentile in terms of impact at 5-on-5 and getting the puck up the ice to his good forwards. So I'd go for him. I know there are some other names that come up. Josh Manson's a physical defenseman. I would have loved Josh Manson 3 or 4 years ago. That would have been the perfect fit on the Leafs blue line, but I think the age curve's kind of caught up with him. I know John Klingberg is a name that you'll hear a lot. I think that's kind of Tyson Barry problem in that he's great on the power play. He's great at walking the blue line with the puck, but against the other team's best players defensively, his impacts are brutal right now. He's really fallen off of a cliff the last couple of years. So I keep coming back to Damon Severson. I know that's not necessarily the name everyone wants to hear. Maybe Rachel Dory in Vancouver will get a kick out of this, and they'll try to trade for him at some point. But I'm a huge fan of his game. I'm a huge fan of his 200-foot impact. I know he doesn't fit that defensive defenseman archetype that a lot of people want the Leafs to trade for, but I just want them to acquire a good player. And Tampa Bay acquired Ryan McDonough when they didn't necessarily need to. To me, this is the best defenseman on the market who you can trade a first-round pick and a B-level prospect for, realistically. I think you go for it.
Are you confident in Severson's ability to defend without the puck with opposing players cycling like that? We all have that in our mind, how he played that 2-on-1. Let's just erase that from our memories for a second. But clearly, we outlined a need. We outlined something that they're not very good at. Can Severson do that effectively in the top four?
Alongside of Jake Muzzin, I think he'd be a good fit if Muzzin comes back. That's a big if. We don't know what the case is with that. If Muzzin comes back in the playoffs off of LTIR, is he good to go? I'm just trying to think of fit here in terms of the Leafs lineup. I know they have Riley on the first pair right now and Brody on the second pair. I think when it's all said and done, you put Riley Brody back together because that's what's worked the best over the last year. I think Muzzin is the one who's going to need a new partner on that second pair. And that's where I see Severson as a great fit because, like you said, defending against the cycle, being strong in front of the net, not necessarily Severson's biggest strength, but he's a fantastic puck mover. And I think if you played that alongside a Muzzin, who in the playoffs is going to be able to get away with a bit more physicality, a bit more slug and tug, cross-checking, hooking. We saw Alex Ovechkin hook last night, Zach Hyman. And penalties aren't getting called. I think Jake Muzzin all of a sudden has a better ability to defend against the cycle. That's where I see that second pair having a good impact at 5-on-5. And then you can have your Sandy and Liljegren or your Sandy and Labushkin third pair. I think in a perfect world, that's my Leafs D pairs going into the playoffs. But again, a lot of this is contingent on Jake Muzzin. That's a huge question mark right now. None of us really know what's going on there.
So I'm not only worried about Muzzin's just health. Like, I hope he's okay. At least he's skating now, and so you got to think that there's no LTIR situation happening, that what the Leafs are saying about getting him back in regular season games is real. The thing that scares me the most about Jake, though, is he has not been as physical this year. Anybody that has watched him knows that the physical play has not been... This isn't the thumper that showed up in Toronto when they first acquired him. He has been far more hesitant. And maybe some of that is just load management, where he says, hey, in a regular season, I shouldn't be playing this way. I got to play a little bit different so I can get to the playoffs. And it's like what Wayne Simmonds did, right? Stewie's told us, like Anthony Stewart has come on with us multiple times and said, hey, the difference with Wayne Simmonds this past offseason is he focused on different elements of his game. And that's what he's also doing in the regular season, and it's translating into someone that has been more effective and someone that maybe, you know, changes that style of play come playoff time where it's, you know, balls to the wall, everything's on the table. So maybe that's the case with Muzzin. But I will say that I don't have the same faith in his ability to just kind of carry that type of a guy and be that kind of anchor, because we saw a pretty significant sample this year of him and Hall, where, yeah, Hall was not great, but where Muzzin wasn't the same guy, wasn't just the automatic carrier when it comes to being that type of guy. And that brings me to, so Blake and I have been having this discussion, and we kind of referenced it a little bit off the top of, how do you take guys that are in more of the mold of what you don't value as much, right? Where you said it, Josh Manson, he's more physical, but not as good of a puck mover. Same thing with Ben Sherratt, where Sherratt it seems pretty clear that he's better when he plays, well, I guess who isn't, but that he's competent and good when he plays with good talent, but when he doesn't, there looks like he's well in over his head. I equated it to Mike Komisarek the other day. If you have a guy that's with Andrei Markov, he can fit with a Markov, you ask him to not be, and it turns out to be a disaster. But how do you look at other guys like that, that are on the market, that might fit more of the bill of giving you roster balance, that don't have those same things that you look for, and trying to figure out whether or not someone is a good fit with good players versus someone that, you know, is just a bottom pairing guy that needs the sheltering and cannot do those things?
Yeah, so I want to push back on the Ben Chiarot point just because I don't see what NHL GMs are seeing when they're willing to give up a first or a second round pick for him right now. When he's on the ice at 5-on-5, he's getting killed. He's hemmed in his own end. And this isn't just this year. This was in the playoffs last year. I know Montreal won a lot of games, but every time Ben Chiarot was on the ice, he was last on the team in shot differential, scoring chance differential, goal differential. You can go through any number you want. Every time he was on the ice, his team was getting killed at 5-on-5. So if I'm trying to acquire a defenseman who fits that physical net front presence aspect of things, I at least want a guy who has a long track record of positive results at 5-on-5. So I wouldn't want Ben Chiarot. Josh Manson you can talk me into, because even though this year hasn't been his strongest year, you can go back 4 or 5 years and see a guy who's consistently tilted the ice in a positive direction. Yes, he played with Hampus Lindholm in his prime, and I think that helped elevate his numbers a bit. But I definitely want a guy who has a long track record, large sample of tilting the ice in a positive direction. And those are the guys who I tend to look for. Damon Severson fit that mold, but again, didn't fit certain characteristics that you're looking for when you're trying to acquire a defenseman. So if I'm looking among guys who fit those characteristics, I want guys who have a positive impact on play. And Ben Chiarot's just not one of those guys for me.
So, Ian, we've talked a lot about Austin Matthews the last little bit, as we should. Obviously, he's playing at a level that's, you know, maybe the highest of anyone in the NHL right now. You don't need the advanced stats to back that up at all. You could just look at it. Is there a perspective that we haven't considered here, maybe in terms of Matthews versus Shesterkin, or just what level Matthews has reached here? Or is this kind of an across the board? You see it, you feel it, the basic stats back it up, the advanced stats back it up.
Yeah, I think that last sentence pretty much sums it up. When you get into Matthews versus Shesterkin, that's more of a philosophical debate. That reminds me of baseball when a pitcher's having a dominant year. Should he win the MVP? And no, we have the separate award for pitchers. It's the Cy Young. We have the separate award for goalies. It's the Vezina. But if I'm just comparing Matthews to other skaters across the NHL, frankly, I don't think it's really close this year for the heart. I think the more interesting discussion for Matthews is the Selke at this point. I think he should, if not win it, be in very serious contention for it, because if you look at his puck battle numbers, if you look at the fact that he never turns the puck over, his turnover rates are among the lowest in the NHL, despite the fact that he has it all the time. If you look at his defensive impacts at 5-on-5, something like even strength, wins above replacement, or the RAPM, all the fancy stuff, all the nerd charts that you're seeing online, they all show him as having a top five impact defensively. And we've never had a guy in the NHL who has a top 10 impact offensively and a top 10 impact defensively. As of right now, I think he's top one offensively, first in the league in terms of 5-on-5 when he's on the ice. Quality chances are going, you're getting lots of chances from in front of the net as the Toronto Maple Leafs and Matthews is on the ice. Defensively, very few are going in against him. So I think he should win the heart. I think he's probably going to win the Rocket. But to me, the most interesting conversation is Selke. A player's never won the Rocket and the Selke in the same season. And I think Matthews has a really good chance to do it. I'd make the argument that he should win it this year. And it's just a truly special season that we're watching right now.
And just bonkers face-off numbers, too, all over the place. So, Ian, what you're saying is he's got all the red blotches in the spots you want the red blotches and all the blue blotches in the spot you want the blue blotches.
He's not Twitter loves him.
Yeah. All right, man. Thanks so much for taking the time. Ian Tulloch, hockey analyst at the Hockey News, at Ian Graff. Appreciate you taking the time this morning, buddy.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. Have a good one.
So that was Ian Tulloch. It's now time for Something to Chew On, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. This Something to Chew On is going to be a little obvious, but I think it ties our bookends of that conversation together well, where we're talking about defensive metrics at 5-on-5 and how certain guys look and the context you need to add to that. And then we end by saying, Auston Matthews might be a top 10 player at both ends of the ice right now. Well, what would flow from that is you've got to control for the Auston Matthews factor. So I was, throughout Kyle Lowry's tenure as a Raptor, I would always pull the Wowie numbers, the with you or without you numbers, and I'd have this giant table that's almost entirely lit up green from the conditional formatting of, hey, every player who plays with Kyle Lowry over any kind of sample sees a jump in true shooting percentage, a jump in net rating, a jump in all the things. Kyle Lowry makes everyone better. We can do that with Auston Matthews as well. He is fourth in the league in expected goals for percentage when he's on the ice, and Bunting and Marner are right there. I took every Leaf who has played at least 35 minutes with Auston Matthews at 5-on-5 this year. That's a list of 15 players. Of those 15, 15 have a better Corsi percentage when they're with Matthews. 15 have a better expected goals for percentage when they're with Matthews. 15 have a better high danger Corsi percentage with Matthews. And even if we want to ditch the expected stuff and go with, hey, what's actually happening? 11 of them have better goal scoring rates and goals against rates with Matthews than without. And yes, Auston Matthews starts more of his possessions or more of his shifts in the offensive zone than an average player. None of this should be anything groundbreaking. It should be obvious. You play with the best player maybe in the league this year, your numbers are going to be better. But I do think sometimes while we're having parallel conversations of Auston Matthews is doing all this great stuff at both ends, he's having this dominant two-way season, and then there's the parallel track of, well, also these other guys who are playing big numbers with him, they have good numbers too. One of those things is probably driving it more. So something to chew on when you're looking at any stats. Shocker, you have to control for a lot of these guys are playing with maybe the best player in the NHL. JD, you're muted, bud.
This is, you just nailed it. And I'm so glad you did it today. Again, you reaching out to me yesterday, it was one of those moments where I went, thank you. Thank you, because Blake, I said it, he knows numbers. He knows how to contextualize these things. When you think you're on Twitter with your egg before a profile picture and your four followers, and you're telling me that I don't understand the numbers, that's fine. Fine. Tell me I don't. Tell me that you are the math genius that has figured out this equation with Timothy Liljegren that is telling you that he is this and it accounts for all the things, blah, 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 blah. Blake Murphy can do that. And if you really don't believe that Auston Matthews is playing a third of the game for the Leafs, he plays a third of the game. And when he's out there, he is dominating. Everyone around his ecosystem is benefiting from his numbers. He's obviously the driver of those things. So if you're Timothy Liljegren, and you play, what, 15 minutes? 14 minutes? 15 minutes was like his higher one for him the other night. You're playing 13 minutes, and you get 8 of them with Auston Matthews on the ice. I think it's going to tilt pretty heavily in your favor, especially given that the Leafs are a good hockey team who are usually up in games and who are usually getting far more of the shots. And then the drop-off goes, oh, well, then who else is he playing with? Okay, well, David Camp's line has already been proven that they don't give up a ton of high-danger shots. They don't give up a ton of bad stuff. Okay, you play with John Tavares? All right, we've been criticizing them this year, but they've also had a shot share that's over 50%. There's not exactly holes on the roster of players that you're with that are going to actually crater your numbers to a degree. The Leafs are a very good team. There's a conversation to be had as to whether or not Liljegren fits better with that team than someone who is the traditional kills the play in the corner guy that can't move the puck the same way that a lot of us are coveting. But the idea that these numbers are in any way not just, hey, the Leafs are good and Auston Matthews is dominant, is kind of asinine.
And it's all connected, right? Like, who's Liljegren's partner right now? Morgan Rielly. Who had been Liljegren's partner? Rasmus Sandin. Those are the two defensemen that Sheldon Keefe is looking to weaponize the most. Those are the two defensemen, Rielly and right. Sandin, that Sheldon Keefe wants to pair with Matthews and Marner and Bunting in order to create the best five-man unit. So in a way, Liljegren is kind of just a part of this and the benefactor, because guess what? In every other situation, you're trying to lessen the load and shelter him a little bit. That's why the numbers are what they are.
He created a goal the other night where he puts a puck on net and it was great, and it was Marner who grabs the rebound and scores, and he funneled it towards the net and it was awesome. He can absolutely make a beautiful tape-to-tape pass. There's no doubt about it. Liljegren can snap the hell out of the puck. But even just ask yourself, like, you want to do the eye test thing, just watch Liljegren in the offensive zone. How many times do you feel like he is the actual driver of the play? How often does he have that Morgan Rielly moment where he takes the puck end-to-end and gets his own entry that way, or is setting up or creating a play in the offensive zone when he's there? I'm sorry, but I think that a lot of times he's just there. He's just the guy that's there around four other, oftentimes, all-star caliber players. It's tough. It's a tough one to evaluate. Let's take a break. Let's come back. I would say that someone who had good numbers at one point that we used to think was really good, now we've learned that intangibles also matter, is Carson Wentz. He's got a contract. Well, he didn't get a new contract, but he's got a new team, and we'll talk about it next on the Fan Morning Show. J.D. Buckus, Blake Murphy, Justin Cuthbert, Sportsnet 59 of the Fan.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 of the Fan, Blake Murphy, J.D. Bunkus, Justin Cuthbert. Give them a follow at J.D. Bunkus, at J.C. Cuthbert on Twitter, J.D. Bunkus on Instagram as well. And we'll push the promo codes later. But dicey, it came down to 58 seconds for the wake and rake last night. No spoilers just yet. One thing that was also spoiled yesterday, my friends who are Indianapolis Colts fans felt over the moon happy that not only did they get out from the $28 million they owed to Carson Wentz, they also picked up some draft picks in the process. Carson Wentz to the Washington Commanders. A lot of picks. There's picks going both ways. So it's the 47th pick and Wentz for picks 42 and 73 and a conditional pick based around Wentz's playing time. My main reaction to this one, other than a little bit of shock that Washington was eating all the money, was sure. I don't know that Carson Wentz at this point is a guy I believe moves the needle a ton. You know, if you're a fantasy player, I think this probably downgrades his environment just a little bit pending other offseason moves. I thought Carson Wentz would be a chip that falls a little later in the quarterback carousel, because the big question that flows is what does Indy do next there?
So congrats to Colts fans on getting off of this contract and getting him moved to Washington and actually getting a positive asset in return. That was a little surprising to me. Not that they would get at least something, because I thought, yeah, he's still a quarterback. He's still a starting quarterback. You're going to get a thing for him. I didn't think that they would get something that could hit being a second-round pick. That being said, it does remind me a little bit of the Kyle Dubas-Lubushkin trade, where people go, wow, amazing job. But it's like, yeah, but it's because they were making up for a mistake that is already – this is a face-saving trade, not a incredible out-of-nowhere trade. You're doing this because you have to do this. That being said, I think if you're a Washington Commanders fan, you're just in hell, because – you're rumored to try to have get Russell Wilson. He didn't want to go to your organization because your organization's a tire fire, and that's why. It's not the NFC thing. We went over this with Mike Florio. Russell Wilson didn't want to go there. And so it hurt the Seattle Seahawks, but it also hurts the Commanders. They go out, and it feels like they got a little desperate. They were desperate for a quarterback, and they address it with a guy who not only has declined in the last couple of years and has not been able to replicate anything close to that near MVP season that he had before the injury, but has real character issues, real leadership issues. I remember this was flagged to me by Donovan McNabb when he came on with me a couple of years ago, that there was resentment in Philadelphia in the locker room around the way that Carson Wentz carried himself after they had won a Super Bowl without him. They won a Super Bowl without him, and he walked around like his bleep didn't stink. And that was the book, is that he kind of purports himself as this, I've read it, I don't like using this, but it's like he's like an aw shucks guy, you know, that he puts himself out, aw, I'm just an aw shucks middle American Carson Wentz leader. And in reality, he keeps coming back with people who don't like the guy, that will happily throw him under the bus when he fails. Look at the way that his Colts teammates reacted when they missed the playoffs, where you had receivers on the team liking tweets about him being a failure. You think anyone in Indianapolis is crying about losing Carson Wentz? So to bring him into a situation where the team is trying to take that next step in Washington, where there's some level of credibility, and you're going to ask someone with his statistics to step in here and be there for a couple of years is nuts to me. I'd rather have Tyler Heinicke on his contract than Carson Wentz for paying out draft picks and then paying him that kind of contract money-wise. So this is nuts to me from their standpoint. I don't think that anyone's going to think that way, that it's a good trade. I usually hate when something's consensus in sports and it feels like we're all piling on and echo chambering, but I can't do the zigzag here and say that I like Carson Wentz for the Commanders. The more interesting part of this is now, what do the Colts do? Because the Colts have a really good team. And all they really needed last year was a guy who hands the ball to Jonathan Taylor and can make some plays, right? There's rumors that they're going to be interested in Garoppolo, but weirdly, to me, that's what I don't want, because I've seen Garoppolo do that, and it's a guy who has a ceiling. I know he made it to that Super Bowl, but do you feel like the Colts are better than the Niners? They're kind of a similar team to the Niners. They're very close of a team to the Niners. If I'm a Colts fan, I want something where I can at least buy myself into thinking that the quarterback could end up with a higher ceiling. I just don't know who that is on the market right now. Like, you're not getting into Jameis territory, are you? Like, I don't know where you go from here.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Colts have the same problem as what the Commanders did, right? And the Commanders thought their solution was with the Colts and Carson Wentz. And really, you know, there's a high variance, I think. Like, you can get great starts from him, but you can get awful ones too. So high variance, but hard ceiling as well. Like, you're only going to get so far with Carson Wentz before he pisses everyone off, and then you have the same exact situation. But I feel like it is, despite having a really good team and now no quarterback, the smart move from Indianapolis. Like, go out there and figure out how to improve at that position, because really that's all they have to improve at to be competitive. Yeah. Now, they play in a really difficult conference, so just getting by is not going to get you there. Like, you can't have an average quarterback and expect to win in the AFC, but you can't expect to win with Carson Wentz in the AFC either. So I think just on that point alone, it was the smart move, and it's a tough, tough look for the Commanders, who apparently last week, you guys might have talked about this, called about Patrick Mahomes and then wound up with Carson Wentz. Like, just a ridiculous thing.
Short conversation there.
Yeah, I mean, you slam the phone down immediately, but like, they went from that, which is stupid, to trying to get Russell Wilson and ending up with Carson Wentz, and now we know exactly what they are. They're going to be an inferior team because their quarterback isn't even close to being good enough.
I'm not even,
and he's paid almost $30 million.
Are you interested in Washington Commanders with Carson Wentz?
Like, I was this.
This is a Colts conversation now. Like, that's what I think is, like, it's not about dunking on the Commanders, I think, as much as it is about trying to figure out what the fit is for the Colts, because they don't have a first round pick, so you're not taking a quarterback in the first round this year. There's no guy that they could evaluate and say, oh, well, that's the dude that's going to step in here right away. We're not the team that's going to take the flyer on Kenny Pickett, for example, and see if he can start.
And Frank Reich is probably in a situation where he's got to do something now, right? Like, this will be his fifth season there, and they've had, you know, competent seasons. They had a 10-win season, 11-win season, but they have won one playoff game in his 4 years. And that roster and that environment there is built to win right now and take advantage of what is not a very good division. Okay. So I think he's going to feel – yeah, I think he's going to feel pressure for a win-now move too. And – but yeah, who is that guy on the quarterback market? I don't really know.
I do. There's two guys. There's two guys that I'd be trying to target, and one of them is definitely available. I don't know if the other one is. If I'm the Colts, I'm trying to figure out, how do I get either Jordan Love or Tyler Huntley? Those are the two guys that I'm looking at and saying, maybe there's more there. And the intriguing part with those two guys is they can both do it with their legs too. So there's the formula for really interesting read option plays behind that offensive line, where you can be a little bit more of what the Niners now hope to be, or at least they thought they could be, with Trey Lance. I liked Huntley last year. I think that he's really good. I don't think that he's a superstar, but he's good. He's competent, and I think that there's more there. And if you're the Colts, can you get into a conversation for that guy? I don't want to trade him if I'm the Ravens, because his contract is so cheap, and I really want to have Lamar Jackson insurance when I have a roster this talented. Yeah. And Lamar is Lamar over the last year, where you go, hey, We just need to make sure that this was an aberration, not the future of our organization. But I also don't think that Huntley is someone who, if you're Baltimore and a team like the Colts comes to you with a big offer or an over-the-top offer for him, that you go, well, this isn't replicable. We still do have Lamar Jackson, and now we can take those assets and build around it, draft a quarterback, do whatever. We took Huntley in, what, the seventh round or something like that, sixth round? We can do that again. We can find another backup that fits here. And same thing goes for the Jordan Love situation. Jordan Love stunk when they showcased him against the Chiefs last year. It was a really, really bad moment for him. So maybe he just sucks. Maybe nobody does want him. But that's a distressed asset. That's a guy who now has no long-term future with the Green Bay Packers and has at least some NFL-level abilities and traits. And this is what I'm saying with the Colts is I don't think that you're a Jimmy Garoppolo away. I don't think you're a game manager of that magnitude. I want somebody who can at least break a play every once in a while. And to me, Garoppolo is just not that dude. We know what it's like if you fall behind with a Jimmy Garoppolo. I wouldn't be so upset if in this market, again, not in an ideal world. In an ideal world, you're the Colts, you go out and you get somebody good. But who's good that you can go get? You're not getting Deshaun Watson. First of all, the Deshaun Watson situation remains murkier than it's ever been, right? These women are now going to testify. Some of these women are now going to testify in front of a grand jury. And they're also not going to trade him within the division to you. Like, you would have to trade so much to get Watson to be in the division versus another team that's outside of it. It's one thing to be in the conference. In the division facing twice a year is a different story. Who's the other QB right now? So you can't draft because you don't have picks. Not this year. Jimmy Garoppolo is available. We already know the ceiling on a team very much like the Colts. And then there are two more wild card flyers that you might be able to get into. I am of the mind of ceiling, and so I'd be looking for the ceiling plays.
Jordan Love.
I don't know. Tyler Jake Beliefs, you tell me. Am I right? Is this what scenario would you want? You want to watch Jimmy G? Jake Beliefs? Let's go.
Jordan Love and Tyler Huntley. JD just wants any quarterback to play his college ball in the state of Utah. Any of those guys will do.